Okay, good evening. We are going to get started, and we're going to kind of skip the announcements because Guy is traveling, and we don't really have too many announcements unless someone else has announcements. Anyone? Bueller? Okay. Wrong lights, but I'll get them, and I'll turn it over to you.
Elizabeth, where's the, oh, you got the switch?
I'll get the switch.
Sounds good.
Ah, the joys of tech setup.
Well, that's why we give it a half an hour. All right, well, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming out here on this cold Valentine's Day evening. I wanted to read to you a couple of prepared remarks here to introduce our guest speaker here, Dr. Frank Summers. And all right, so it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, someone who has spent decades helping the rest of us see the universe not just more clearly, but more cinematically. Dr. Frank Summers is an outreach astrophysicist from the Space Telescope Science Institute, where he has spent the last 25 years bringing the wonders of Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope to the public through press, education, museums, planetariums, and fittingly for tonight's event, film. As his bio notes, he has a specialty in creating accurate and aesthetic scientific visualizations by combining research data and computer simulations with Hollywood software and production. A combination that explains why his work looks so good and why the rest of us can't get a decent Starfield to render on our laptops. His credit includes serving as writer, science advisor, and visualization supervisor on the IMAX film Hubble 3D, contributing to the Academy Award-nominated Cosmic Voyage, which I'm sure many of us have seen, and directing Hubble Galaxies Across Space and Time. In short, if it's big, stunning, and cosmic, and shown on a screen, there's a good chance that Frank had something to do with it. He illuminates and elucidates the awesome beauty and intricate wonders of our universe, which is exactly what we're here for tonight. When he's not reimagining the universe, Dr. Summers is apparently out on the disc golf course.
Although not with all the snow.
Snow. Proving that even astrophysicists occasionally prefer trajectories that stay within the Earth's atmosphere. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Frank Summers for his talk, Cinematic Astronomy.
Thank you. It is great to be here, and as I was telling a few of the people beforehand, I think to be back here. Because as I was going through my talks for this, I noticed that I had another PowerPoint that ended in NCA. And so I was like, oh, I must have given another talk. And this room feels familiar. All right. So, yes, my talk is entitled Cinematic Astronomy. And I call myself an astrophysicist. Okay. This is a term I made up myself because it sounds cool and because it is a combination of astrophysicist and visualization, just adding in the viz instead of the fizz. And it sort of it expresses my desire to keep it scientifically as real as possible while really trying to up the visualization aspect. So what does an astrophysicist do? It's easier if I don't tell you, but rather I just show you. Here is a sort of a greatest hits video, but it's not fully the greatest hits, but yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So that was 18 of the, please go ahead. I appreciate it. That was 18 of the visualizations that we've done over the years, selected by the editor, Danny Kirschenblatt. But I have done just a few more visualizations over my many years at Space Telescope Science Institute, not just for Hubble, but also for Webb, and also for a variety of other things, including a whole bunch of constellation ones that we did recently. Okay? And so those probably went by a little too fast. So I was going to highlight a couple, but they were already highlighted in my introduction. Okay? This is how I started doing IMAX film Cosmic Voyage. And this here is actually my PhD thesis simulation on cosmology that was put was done higher and higher, at much higher resolution, and then put on screen in Cosmic Voyage. So I get to say that my PhD thesis was nominated for an Academy Award.
Wow.
Very cool.
Because this was, all right, this is all cut off, but whatever. Best documentary short subject, it was nominated. It did not win. Some film about a guy in an iron lung beat us out. Oh, well. Okay. I also was going to mention Hubble Galaxies Across Space and Time, which is one that I directed and did a lot of most of the visualization for. It's an IMAX short. We won Best Short Film from the Large Format Cinema Association in 2004. Mm-hmm. IMAX Hubble 3D, where writer, science advisor, scientific visualization supervisor, yada, yada. This film is 37 minutes long, but contains 13 minutes of scientific visualization, which I was really impressed that they put so much of our stuff into it. And one that wasn't mentioned in your intro, we worked with this gentleman, Eric Whitaker, composer, his film, Deep Field, The Impossible Magnitude of Our Universe. And it contains at least another 13, if not another 15 minutes of our work in Deep Field. Basically, it really is another one of our greatest hits things. So he wrote a symphony inspired by the Hubble Deep Field, and we helped him illustrate it with things from the universe. Okay, No, this is being recorded. I can't say that. Sorry. There's an update to this project that I can't reveal yet. If this wasn't being recorded, I could tell you. So ask me afterwards after the Zoom is off, okay?
Sure.
Right. So that's the precursor stuff, okay? What I really want to talk to you about tonight is my work on what we call the AstroViz project, okay? And the AstroViz project is part of NASA's Universe of Learning, which is funded by NASA's Science Mission Directorate for the last 10 years, but then the Trump administration put out their budget request last May and zeroed out the Science Activation Program's funding, so we don't actually have any funding this year. So we're supposed to have another recompetition this year. We were supposed to have a recompetition last year, but due to Trump's budget, they couldn't hold the recompetition. They're supposed to hold the recompetition this year. Do you know what Trump did earlier this week? He paused the funding for the Science Activation Program, okay? It's supposed to only be a 10-day pause, right? But if that pause doesn't get lifted, then we won't have the recompetition this year. So supposedly we'll have funding starting January 2027. All right, so there's nothing going on the AstroViz project this year, so I can tell you about all the 10 years of stuff that I did before, okay? All right, so my piece of the Universe of Learning is running the AstroViz project, and as I wrote here, create visualizations of NASA data that help explain the science behind, build better mental models of, and increase interest in astronomical objects, okay? So we're explaining the science, we're helping you see it in 3D, and hopefully the public is getting more enthusiasm for them because they see all this stuff, all right? And you know, we not only create the visualizations, we try to develop new techniques and tools, and we give everything away, okay? We're paid for by NASA, so everything is free. And really, we have an emphasis on multi-wavelength visualizations. point is that I don't just do Hubble, and for this project, I don't just do Webb. I also do Spitzer and Chandra and any other NASA telescope. It's all paid for by NASA, so they want it to be their telescopes. But other than that, I have no restrictions.
Okay.
So here are six of the AstroViz project visualizations that I'm not going to talk about in detail. You can see they are the Orion Nebula up here, the Whirlpool Galaxy here, the Crab Nebula here, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field here, the Eta Car in the center here, and Stefan's Quintet of five galaxies. And so we take these, all right, and as you saw in the previous viz, we put them into three dimensions and motion, and we explain them, all right? The idea being allowing you to experience this, and as I like to say, let me give you a piece of my mind, okay? Let me let you see in these images what I see as an astronomer, okay? Because most of the public, they see a nebula, they say it's really pretty, but they don't have a way of imagining what that structure in 3D is, okay? So those are six of them I'm not gonna talk about in detail. The two I am gonna talk about ones are ones that you probably, at least this crowd knows. Start with Cosmic Cliffs, okay? So when JWST had its first early release observations, the first observations released, one of them is this image, the Cosmic Cliffs, all right? And unfortunately, there are two things wrong with this. First of all, this is not in the Carina Nebula, okay? The PI on this insisted it's in the constellation Carina, it's near the Carina Nebula, but it's not. And the second thing is this is not NGC 3334. That's a star cluster. This is actually the edge of a nebula called GUM 31. Let me show you, okay? So here is the Carina Nebula right here. And the stuff you know about, like Eta Car is in here, Trumpler 14 is in here, all the cool stuff is usually happening down in here, okay? Over here is GUM 31, okay? This is this nebula over here to the side of Carina, not quite in close, you know, right? And then on the side of it, which you can't see here, it's cut off, it's available here on this screen. Mm-hmm. You want to turn this around that they can see. There we go.
Okay.
All right, NGC 3334 is this star cluster here, mm-hmm. and then down below it is the Cosmic Cliffs here. Okay, all right. So part of what we did in doing this is we gave this orientation video, right? So this is what we call flight to the Carina Nebula. And what's really cool about this, it uses the Gaia star catalog. Mm-hmm. So every star you're going to see here is real and at its real 3D distance. See how we did is, of course, we're NASA, we got advertised the NASA telescopes, mm-hmm. showing you where each one of those comes from. So in working in the story throughout all of this, we're going to start with the giant Carina Nebula mosaic. This one is like 12,000 pixels high and like 20,000 pixels across, a really big giant mosaic made by Hubble. And we're going to start actually over here at Trumpler 14. Ada Carr is over here. And there are several other images. These dust pillars were actually a Hubble release. This floaty thingy here was a Hubble release. And I think one of these, well, I think maybe this one up here. Oh, yeah, and Mystic Mountain is over here. So I got to say the press office at Space Telescope really mined this image. There are at least four or five different press release images that came out of it, okay? So we'll start with the Hubble image, okay? Then we'll move to the X-ray image from Chandra. And you probably haven't heard of this. This was one of the biggest surveys ever done with the Chandra X-ray Observatory. It was called CCCP. And those of you who remember that the old Soviet Union, USSR, translated into Cyrillic as CCCP. Remember the hockey players had
right.
Right. The Chandra something something project. the guys who were of Russian descent decided that they were going to name it. Okay, so this is the Chandra survey. And you can see it covers a huge amount of the Kuiper Nebula, as seen in this cutout down here. Okay. Also, looking at the full Kuiper Nebula is the Spitzer Infrared. Now, this is from the GLIMP survey, okay, where they did a full 360 around the Milky Way on the sky. And so this covers not only the Carina Nebula here, but also reaches over to Gum-31 over here. Gum-31, we don't have a good optical image from a space telescope because it's just too bloody big. So this is a ground-based observation from a gentleman whose last name is Heppel, and it uses what's called SHO, sulfur hydrogen oxygen. You guys are observers, those of you who are observers know this well,
right.
This has also been informally called the Hubble palette, okay, because Hubble adopted this for certain images and suddenly everybody loves it, okay. So sulfur in red, hydrogen in green, oxygen in blue, all right. And down here is where the
cutout. Oh, wow.
And this is the Hubble version of the cosmic eclipse. Okay, this was released. This is a WithPic 2 image, so it's not as high resolution as it could be. It wasn't done again with WithC3. It's WithPic 2 image, so it's good resolution. Nothing wrong with it. Okay, but the James Webb version of it in with NearCam is a bit more striking because it has roughly twice the resolution the Hubble image has, okay? 2 to 3 times the resolution, all right? And so this is what we're going to use for our thing. And notice, this is our thumbnail that we use for the YouTube video. And it has the Hubble, it has the Chandra, it has the Spitzer, and it has the Webb. Emphasizing our approach for multi-wavelength. Okay, so I'm gonna play you the video. It's like 4.5 minutes, all right? And it's got me narrating it, so I don't have to narrate it live for you, okay? All right, so this is our star formation from Carina Nebula to the cosmic cliffs.
The star cluster Trumpler 14 is a glittering jewel in the Carina Nebula.
Whoops.
These newly formed hot stars energize a huge cavity within the gas and dust. In energetic X-rays, star clusters Trumpler 14 and 15 blaze brightly, along with the massive star Eta Carinae. Mysterious diffuse X-rays appear to emanate from the boundaries between gas and dust. The nebula expelled by Eta Carinae is tremendously bright in infrared light. Infrared showcases the dust surrounding cavities of gas throughout the nebula. The Carina Nebula is a vast and complex cloud where tens of thousands of stars have formed. Off to the side is a smaller nebula called Gum 31. Seemingly separate in visible light, dust connects the structures in infrared light. The cavity of Gum 31 is created by the star cluster NGC 3324. Hundreds of newborn stars are revealed in X-rays. High energy radiation from the massive stars creates a sharp boundary between the gas and dust. Heated dust molecules break apart to become ionized atoms of gas. These boundaries, known as ionization fronts, can resemble mountainous landscapes. This Webb Space Telescope infrared image is nicknamed Cosmic Cliffs. The cliffs within the image are actually dust clouds. Blasted by stellar winds and energetic radiation, some form pillars that point back toward the star cluster. Resembling mist on mountainsides, ionized gas rises and streams away from the dust clouds. A new star forming deep within the clouds spews out long jets of energetic particles. The cliff edges illustrate the sharp boundary between cold dust and hot gas. Star formation occurs throughout the Carina Nebula complex. Dust clouds collapse to form stars. Clusters of newborn stars energize their surroundings. Stellar winds and radiation carve cavities within the dust clouds. Multi-wavelength observations from NASA space telescopes provide diverse views to examine and explore the universe.
All right, sorry, my wife just texted and I was like, oh, I forgot to set do not disturb mode. Okay, so that gets you through the cosmic cliffs, okay? Thank you very much. And there was something I was gonna add on the end of that. My wife distracted me. All right, so if I remember, I'll bring it up later. Okay, so that is the cosmic cliffs. Oh, I know where it was. And you'll notice that most of that was sort of just 2D work, getting down to the cosmic cliffs, and then we pull it into 3D. Okay, we do a lot of time setting up the science and the understanding before we then give you that ooh cool the 3D aspect of it that works. Okay, now let's do the same for another almost even more famous image, the Pillars of Creation. Okay, so if you're old like me, you remember what we're seeing, the original Pillars of Creation from 1995. With the two hulls, okay? And then we decided when we got with C3 on Hubble that we should do it again. So we took this and turned it into that with Hubble, okay? So wide field camera 3, it'll get us, you know, 16 million pixels of Hubble goodness on this stuff. But that's not good enough, okay? Because once this becomes an iconic image, okay, doing it just with Hubble optical is one thing, but we also did it with Hubble in infrared, okay? Mm-hmm. And look at that, go back, and that's optical and that's infrared. It really changes, all right? And that sort of gives you an idea of, hey, you know what's coming next. The James Webb Space Telescope has to do it. And here's Webb's image of it, okay? So we got Webb, you got Hubble infrared and Hubble optical, okay? But Webb just doesn't have the near cam on it. It also has the mid infrared, and there is it with MIRI, okay? So this is a lot of fun, okay? MIRI, near cam, Hubble IR, Hubble optical. Really cool stuff, okay? So we got five different images from which to gain information about this object for that we're gonna use for a visualization. But there's one thing you should recognize, that these are all at the same scale on the sky, right? Mm-hmm. If I actually switched it to pixel scale, you would see that almost all of them are, that only the Hubble optical and the Webb near cam are actually lots and lots of pixels, okay? That original one here from Hubble, relatively tiny, okay? It was 800 by 800, okay? Or 1600 by 1600. Okay, this is 4,000 by 4,000. You can see even the mid-infrared image is about the same scale as the original Hubble image, okay? All right, so we're gonna rely on these two for most of our visualization here, okay? So we got the Hubble optical and the Webb near cam, all right? Now, one thing you're gonna need, you need to understand about this before we go in too deep, is that this is inside the Eagle Nebula. This whole thing here is the Eagle Nebula, okay? And this star cluster here is incredibly important, okay? That star cluster is shining its radiation and its winds in this direction and creating these pillars, okay? It's a reason why the top of this pillar is so honking bright. Okay, that's a technical term, honking. Okay, just ask my visualization team. They know that term well. Okay, the tops of these are so bright because they're being hit by ultraviolet radiation from these hot young stars. Matter of fact, there's actually just three O stars that are most important. Okay, I'll reference them later in the talk. To create this, and that's why it's so streamlined, because you've blown away all the low density gas, leaving behind the high density clumps. Okay? So, let's talk about that density, which is really important, because when you look at that Hubble image, you look like this looks like it's a nice high density clump. Okay? But if you look in Webb, in infrared, you see all these stars that you can see through the gas? Okay? The gas and dust here that you're seeing from Webb. It shows that this is not very high density, all right? You have a dense top up here, but the body of this tall pillar is actually pretty empty. And you would know that if you had studied the Hubble infrared, okay? So you can see that there, where it's all black, that is the high density stuff. Sort of looks like a spider with its legs stretching downward, okay? But here, there's really not that much density there, okay? Whereas in Hubble, it looks like it's high density. In Webb and in the infrared, it doesn't look like it's high density. This is also true over on the small pillar, what we sometimes call the dog pillar. All right, can you see the four legs of the dog, the tail, you know, the back legs, a little Scottish Terrier or something dancing around in the nebula? you can't see it over here, can you? Oh, well. If you look on here, you can see. sorry, the projector didn't sync as well as it should. But if you could see this, you could see that there's a lot of dark gas here. And then when we go to the Webb, you see that same thing reflected there. What's kind of cool is that this here, you can see these sort of striations, okay? They're sort of like, they feel like ribs coming down it, Okay, you see that in the Hubble infrared as well. Whoops. All right, you see that in the Hubble infrared as well. And one of the things that I had wondered about was, what is this blue stuff here, right? And all that sort of stuff. Is it part of it or something? When you look at it here, did that mean that, like, oh, was there a cutoff here or anything? And we'll get to that in just a second. But you can see how this is connected in here in the middle pillar, okay? One of the really cool features is these ionized gas outflows. As I said, the ultraviolet radiation is hitting these pillars, ionizing the dust, and the gas is flowing away, okay? And so here at the top of the tall pillar, you can see, there we go, this yellow gas flowing away. It's yellow in the color scheme we've used with Hubble here, right? And you can see this all flowing away. And if I go between the Hubble to the web, right, you see a little bit of the streaming away, but not anywhere near as much as you see in the Hubble. All right, Hubble and web. The other thing you'll notice is, look at the level of the surface of it. Okay, there's Hubble, there's web. Hubble, web. What's going on here? How come it's not the same surface? Because it's not the same gas that's emitting in optical versus infrared. Mm-hmm. The infrared is cooler gas, which is lower down. It's deeper in the thing. So when we model this, we actually have to model the web thing as being smaller, right? Inside, it's like you could fit the, you know, if you've got your Hubble model here, your web model has to fit inside it just a little bit, and you shave off a little bit on all things to get your web model. Okay, central pillar, okay? You can see the beautiful striations of things here, a little bit here in the blue in web, okay? Now, for the small pillar, the dog pillar, okay, we have two interesting pieces right here. You see this little piece here, and you see this yellow flow off of that. There's also a yellow flow coming off of here, okay? This is the furthest, closest towards you pillar, and it's being hit mostly on the back side. That's why it's so dark, okay? This is why it's so dark, is because it's back illuminated, all right? So if you follow that from here, you can see that there's a little bit of flow here, and then it looks like it heads off to the west, okay? You can also feel like, come on, that there is some flow coming off the back of this thing and stretching over here, becoming all this yellow stuff over here, okay? That yellow triangle on the middle pillar always bothered me until I finally studied it and said, ah, now I see what's going on. It's the gas flowing off the third pillar that's actually flowing out in front of there. So that's kind of cool. We get to do some modeling of some gas in 3D space, okay? So we have that in Hubble, and here in web, and you see that same light blue gas here corresponding to it. You see a tiny bit of it here, okay? So we're utilizing what we can see in both wavelengths to try and help us come up with a three-dimensional model. One feature that I absolutely had to bring the camera in close, up close and personal with is what I called the crown of fingers, okay? So over here on the top of the large tallest pillar, you will see these little fingers sticking up, and you'll see them also here in infrared. Boom. It's not going. Sometimes my. All right, so all of these little fingers sticking up, okay? So as I said, the radiation stuff is hitting the top of that pillar strongest, okay? It's really directing. And the densest knots in there are actually resisting it, forming these mini pillars on top of the big pillar. Because, I mean, this pillar itself is like 3 light years long, okay? And so now we have these, you know, very small little pillars up on top of that, okay? There is also an embedded protostar, and this is in the middle pillar, which we like to call the Dementor pillar. Okay. All right, come on. Harry Potter,
yes,
the Mentor, absolutely. Right?
Absolutely.
Right? As soon as you see it, you can't unsee it, can you, right? Okay. So at the top of the Dementor pillow, what's being covered by this meeting is being recorded a message.
That's on your screen.
That's on my screen. Well, I can't do anything about it because it's not there on my screen. Okay. So here at the top of it, all right, here is the top. And again, we were talking about the striations of the stuff flowing away. And you can see that sort of empty region here. You can see that empty region there too in it, all right? And this and these were taken, you know, this is 2015, this is 2022, 2023. Okay, so these are years apart, but you can still see the same gap in the hair. Oh, and that's a cool thing, okay? Remind me to tell you about the hair later, okay? And so you can see, however, you got this red splotch here, there's a little red splotch here, and there's this big red splotch here. What's going on here? Well, There is a protostar forming in here, okay? Wow. Somewhere around that white circle, okay? This is a velocity map done by a team using some telescopes in Chile. And this is in blue shifted, which is coming towards you. And this is red shifted, going away from you. And the interpretation is that there is a new star here with a jet coming this way out towards you and this way. So it's internal inside the pillar, okay? And here in Hubble, you see it just interacting with the surface, and then you see it interacting as it's leaving over there, okay? But in Webb, which sees deeper into the pillar, right? You're actually seeing a bit more of the jet and its interaction there, all right? So you're actually able to see it. So we really wanted to highlight that there was this cool feature going on there, right? Okay, in the embedded jet from a protostar, okay? There is also a very much more easily seen jet, which is over on the tall pillar, okay? And so this is Hubble 1995, and you can see this jet sitting right here. And you may not be convinced. So let me go back to Mystic Mountain image. This is Hubble's ERO in 2010. Okay, and you see this small little finger here. You see that jet coming out there. That's the birth announcement of a newborn star. Okay, there's your birth announcement. There's also one here. You can see these jets. Okay, so these jets show you that, all right, this is what's happening, and it's something easy to see. Well, it's a little, now that you have your eyes trained for it, you can see that it extends down here, and then it sweeps over. It comes up here, you see that knot there, and then there's another knot up here, okay? All right, so let us go to the Hubble 2015 image, and back to the 1995, 20 years. Are you seeing, oops, sorry. You look at this knot right here, mm-hmm. and this knot right here, that's the easiest to see, that you actually see motion mm-hmm. over 20 travel, years.
Yeah.
Kind of cool. Oops. All right. You also see this jet in the web image. Sorry, I keep hitting the wrong buttons. My clicker decides it's, and then, all right. The web is unfortunately off screen, but those of you on Zoom probably can see it, that you can see the web image, you can also see this jet sitting out there. So that was a really cool thing that we could do. There are also some really fun things to look at in newborn stars, okay? We talk about these pillars of creation. There are supposed to be newborn stars. And so I went searching around. I had to find some, okay? And turns out they're well located down here. And so here on the, there's one here on the left and another here on the right. And you say, well, how do we know this is a newborn star? There's a dot here. That could be a foreground star. That could just be a red dwarf that's, you know, 100, 200 light years away that just happens to be in the same direction. Trust me. If you go to the web image, you see this. Boom. Both of those stars come out really strong. And if you go to the mid-infrared, wham, okay, you get a really honking bright star, okay? So this was one that we had a lot of questioning, because I'm a scientist, right? I'm gonna make sure that I is like, is that really what I want? I'm gonna claim it is in the movie. Yes, it is. Those both are newborn stars. We actually only use this one here on the left. We couldn't get down to doing both of them in the movie. Okay. So now we take all that information that we do. We studied this. We read through the papers. We worked with a researcher from Durham University in the UK. She joined us on our calls, and we built our 3D model and everything. And I could go spend another hour telling you how we built this 3D model, or I could just show you the behind-the-scenes video that we created for this. Coming attractions that we released at the American Astronomical Society meeting, because normally we release the whole video, but this was so complex that we didn't actually release it till like April instead of January. So I had to have something for this. And so I said, oh, let's just create a behind the scenes trailer. And it went over like gangbusters at AAS. Everyone absolutely loved it. It went too fast for a lot of these things. So let me just highlight a few special things. Okay. First of all, it's not me doing all of this, okay? There are 9 people who worked on the Pillars of Creation and who worked on cosmic cliffs and most of the other things, okay? It used to be me, Greg Bacon, me, and 2 others, Zolt LaVey and Lisa Fertari. We started with a group of 4, and slowly over the decade and a half, we built up to 9 team members. Yay! Okay, Greg and I are so happy to have such a talented team, okay? All right. We put the stars into the 3-dimensional model, okay? So you saw all those pillars, here the wireframe of our pillars, right? And we placed the 3 really important stars in there for a really special region, okay? Because what we wanted to be able to do was light the model, okay, after we'd sculpted it and lit it, and try and get part of our sculpting was to match the gold tones in the Hubble image, because in the Hubble image, what's shining with the ionization front is the stuff that's being hit by this ionizing radiation. So the idea was to get the bright spots here to match the bright spots here, okay? You know, we can't get it perfect, okay, because nobody truly knows the three-dimensional structure of this, but it allowed us to figure out, okay, this is coming out, this is in, and figure out where the things that are in. So I will also say, we don't exactly know where those three stars are located. We had an approximate position, so, you know, a lot of this is approximate, okay? But it's all based on good science. Then, what was so cool, and I hadn't thought about this in a while because I haven't given this talk in a while, is that when you look at pillar 1B, okay, so it's at the bottom of the tall pillar, okay, in Hubble, it's dark, okay? That means it's dust, okay, and also that it's being backlit, okay? And so you say to yourself, okay, if it's dark in Hubble, why is it glowing so much in Webb? And we didn't quite understand this, okay, until we were informed by my friend out at JPL, who said, oh yeah, that's fine, it is being backlit, but it is now re-radiated at higher, longer wavelengths that actually make it through the dust so that you can see that. So from the front of this, the Hubble version of it, we can sculpt the front of this pillar, and from the Webb version, we're actually seeing the back of it, okay? That can help us sculpt the back of it. That was really kind of cool when you're going through the multiple things. The other thing that you probably didn't recognize so quickly is that the effects break out. So we model the pillars, okay? And then we modeled all these effects on top of them in terms of things, especially here you can see the ionization things, which we did, and I kid you not, via the Hollywood technique for hair, okay? Y'all remember Monsters, Inc.,
yeah.
Okay? An amazing breakthrough in doing film because nobody had really tried to do hair this complex. So Hollywood has built up this tremendous amount of tools for doing hair on animals and everything, and so they can make it do exactly what it wants, and they can clip it and cut it. And so we got to art direct our ionization fronts using their hair tools, okay? We first tried to say, oh, let's emit particles from it, and let's see, I was like, yeah, not sure that's gonna work. It didn't work, but hey, one of our mantras is fail early, fail often, okay? Get your mistakes out of the way quickly. And then when we went to hair, just the Hollywood tools allow us sort of like to come in and sculpt it and get the ionization fronts to match what we're seeing in the images, all right? And so we put all this together, and one of the really coolest things that happened last year was it was selected for SIGGRAPH. SIGGRAPH Computer Graphics Conference has the most prestigious festival of computer graphics of the year, and we were in the animation theater. And I got to go to Vancouver and give a little talk on it and everything, and, you know, be adored by a computer graphic. No, actually, get my tiny little moment of fame on this. Okay, so this is Pillars of Creation. And it includes a very extensive opening sequence to orient you to get the idea of dust and gas and star formation, okay? The interplay of gas and dust.
The luminous band of our Milky Way galaxy stretches across the night sky. It is a contrasting combination of bright starlight and dark dust lanes. Stars along the pancake-like disk are seen in short wavelength infrared light, while long wavelength infrared light features the dense dust clouds. These dark dust clouds are places where new stars can form. Newborn hot stars heat the dust clouds, and their cores glow brightly. The Eagle Nebula is the birthplace of a cluster of luminous young stars. Infrared light can trace the dusty skeleton of the nebula. And X-ray observations reveal over 1,000 stars in the central cluster. The largest stars in the cluster emit strong stellar winds and energetic radiation, which stream across the nebula and shape the iconic Pillars of Creation. Made famous by the Hubble Space Telescope using visible light, the pillars are equally amazing in the infrared view of the Webb Space Telescope. Examining their structure in three dimensions, they separate into individual clouds. The right pillar is closest and is backlit by the star's intense radiation. Glowing ionized gas streams away from the pillars. The infrared view of the central pillar reveals vibrant evidence of an embedded protostar. The top of the left pillar is directly bombarded by energetic starlight. Dense pockets of dust resist the erosion and create narrow, finger-like peaks. Lower down, jets from a newborn star shoot away from a peak. The semi-transparent body of the pillar lies in the shadow of the dense top. A newborn star blazes at the end of this peak, underscoring the nickname, Pillars of Creation. Stars form in these dusty pillars. The dusty pillars are shaped by emissions from young stars. The young stars form within giant dust clouds. Dust clouds and stars are strewn across the plane of our galaxy. The interplay of stars and dust creates cosmic structures on many scales.
So, now for the finish. I'll get your, please applaud if you want. I'm never going to be upset if people applaud. So, the watchwords here in what we do are accuracy and aesthetics, the science rigor, as well as trying to use as much Hollywood, steal as much from Hollywood as possible in order to make it cinematic for the public, okay? So here are those AstroViz project visualizations with the Pillars of Creation and star formation. And hopefully in 2027, I will be able to add more to this, all right? I won't be able to add things. But really, you know, we have a method to our madness in terms of, it's not just about creating pretty pictures, okay? It's a lot about creating pictures, but it's not just about creating pretty pictures. There's the beauty and awe and wonder of the universe that we try to translate to people, okay? But we want to build up an idea of what's going on in here the scaffolding of the concepts. We take you from the Milky Way to you see the dust cloud, you see the individual clouds, you see the dust clouds within those in the pillars and the such. All right. I'm a big fan of this phrase that I've been using for decades now called visual intuition. Okay. I think that if you see it and I show it to you with enough clarity, you can start to gain an intuition. I first developed this when I was doing galaxy collision visualizations, okay? If I show you pictures of galaxy collisions, you have no bloody idea. But if I give you a simulation and I let you follow it, you start to get, oh yeah, you can feel the physics is right, okay? There was, side story, there was a really, really well-meaning visualizer at one of these studios that tried to do a galaxy collision using the gravity solver in one of the 3D packages. Mm-hmm. And you watched it and you go, no, that's just totally fake. You knew it wasn't right, okay, without actually having any good reason for it, because your visual intuition said, no, that just doesn't work, okay? And really, you know, I'm able to give you that three-dimensional mental model of the structures going on in here. You will never look at that Pillars of Creation image again without going, oh, okay, it's actually four separate pillars that are spaced out and such. A lot of people think they're just sitting in a line. No, they are actually spaced out like that, okay? So that is what I get paid to do. Yes, they actually pay me to do this, which is kind of fun, all right? If you would like to explore more, you can go to my YouTube channel, because I know it's going to be there. The reason I'm doing this is because NASA took away our Hubble Space Telescope channel on YouTube a year and a half ago. They said we want to control everything that says Hubble on it, so they took away our Hubble Space Telescope channel. We have since moved, we're in the almost finished moving all of the old Hubble Space Telescope videos over to our Space Telescope Science Institute channel. But in the meantime, I put my channel together, and so you can find all my most of my astronomy visualizations. I also was host of the public lecture series for 22 years. I did a very, very popular podcast, but you can find all these videos here on that. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention tonight. So, anybody in the room have questions that they would like to bring out? Yes.
Yeah, I have one. You showed an image of one of the web images.
Yes.
And you showed this star, and it was radiating out, and it seemed, instead of just a jet coming out at opposite sides, it looked like there were five or six different jets.
You're not talking about the point spread function, because web does have a actual eight-pointed point spread function. Hubble has four points in its point spread function. Webb has six due to the hexagonal mirrors, and then two extra because of the arrangement of those things. So if you go to a Webb image, and let me just...
That's that newborn star was the one.
You're talking about the newborn star. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all right.
That's what I'm referring to.
I think you're talking about, like, here?
Yeah, that's
it. Yes, okay.
Yes.
So you'll notice that this has six sides to it, okay?
Right.
Yes.
Due to the hexagonal mirrors in Webb, and there are 18 of them that work together, okay?
Right.
So yes, and if you go, if I go to the Webb, I guess we don't have a bright enough one here in Webb. But you can see the spikes. There are also six there. If you go to a really bright web image, let me go back to Cosmic Cliffs. Where's Cosmic Cliffs? Here. There. Okay. You can see that it's got the six here and then these two here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And those are the diffraction spikes due to the arrangement of the mirrors.
So it's an artifact of the data.
That's an artifact of it. And the Roman Space Telescope is going to have even funkier ones.
Yeah.
Okay. And that launches in hopefully October of this year. But it's going to have like 12 pointed stars.
Yeah.
And the imaging team is like, oh shit, that's going to be even more work to try and clean that up, because you never take the images are always take and they're offset and they're spun a little bit, and you know, you have to, the public doesn't understand if you've already got a 12 pointed star and it turns into a 24 pointed star, it's they'll have to try and rotate to try and fix that up. Anyways, you had a question.
Yes. Well, I had a really quick follow-up, but then a separate question. Given that that's a very well-understood phenomenon mathematically, right, in terms of diffraction spikes, is there some automated means of cleaning those images up through filters?
In terms of the diffraction spikes?
Removing the diffraction spikes for the purposes of visualization.
We generally, all right, so the public likes to see diffraction spikes, okay? So
yeah.
For our press release images, we generally don't, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where we have to, where we try to remove, where we need to remove diffraction spikes is if we want, if this, like this star here in the center, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's covering up nebula. And if you want
right.
to know what's that nebula looks like, you have to go in and do a PSF subtraction.
Right.
Okay? If you were looking for, say, a planet around a bright star, you'd have to do a PSF subtraction.
Sure.
Okay. There are really sophisticated codes for doing those PSF subtractions, and they mostly work. Okay, if you remember, there are a couple exoplanets that have been found via this PSF subtraction technique,
mm-hmm.
Because you know, somebody else got an indication that there's a exoplanet around this star,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, well, we've got data on that. Let's see if we can PSF subtract and pull out and actually see the planet. And then a couple
sure.
cases we have been able to do that.
Sure.
So yeah, that's really important. And I'll give you another thing, that when we fly through this image in 3D, none of that is real. It's all synthetically generated.
Mm-hmm.
So we take this image, we analyze it, we figure out every star, where it is, where its centroid is,
mm-hmm.
what its relative brightnesses are in red, green, and blue, in the,
mm-hmm.
or the various filters that it used.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can create the PSFs to float in 3D.
Right.
Okay, instead of trying to like cut out each individual PSF and then put it on its own little postage stamp to fly through in 3D, we can actually create those from scratch. So we make a catalog of the stars in the image, and
mm-hmm.
this one has like 10,000 stars or so in it,
right.
And it's complex. So when we do the 3D things, we used to start out by trying to actually pull things out of the image,
mm-hmm.
and then we realized, if we go to the if we make a catalog of the stars and then synthetically create them from the PSFs,
mm-hmm.
it looks almost exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you guys wouldn't be able to tell the difference. We who look at the images all the time would be able to tell the difference, but if we're just casual looking at it, we wouldn't be
sure.
able to tell the difference. Other questions?
Very impressive. Yeah. So I find this particularly interesting because 25 years ago, I was a co-founder of a graphics company, and we actually had a SIGGRAPH event there.
Cool.
So very, very much into that. Can you comment? Obviously, this is a data-driven process. You said there were certain steps there where some liberties are taken, obviously. In terms of the sculpting of the three-dimensional forms of these clouds, and then also the particular rendering algorithms that you're using, right,
yeah.
to achieve volumetric effects and whatnot, and then the tools. I'm sorry if that's too technical for some folks. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because I'm deeply
okay.
curious.
So there's a lot we don't know. Like we don't know what the backside of these pillars look like.
Mm.
You'll notice that I didn't fly around the backside of the pillars. My artists were like, "Yeah, we don't know what that looks like," and I like, "Yeah, but you can make it up. You know, what it looks like in the front is probably what it looks like in the back." But you know. Then you sit there and think about it more carefully. Well, the backsides are being heavily irradiated, so they're actually going to look a lot different
yeah.
And stuff like that. But we do go around the sides of like that, especially that central pillar, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so we just extrapolated from what we see to what we
mm-hmm.
to a certain amount that we don't see. We did the same thing in the Orion Nebula. When we fly into the Orion Nebula, we get up close and personal with the tritium. There's that whole cave in there that
mm-hmm.
we don't know. We just extrapolated from
okay.
what we do see. So that's where we take artistic license, okay?
Gotcha.
There's stuff that we can't see from Earth
sure.
That we do that. The biggest thing that we don't do is we don't keep the exposure down accurate. Okay, you fly up to a star, it's going to blow out your lens, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't do. So we keep the stars fixed in brightness. Okay, so we fly up to them. They don't have the one over our square brightening as we fly up to them, because it's right. just, you know, it would ruin the thing. Okay,
sure.
We're flying many times faster than the speed of light and all this.
Right.
We don't take full pull any of that, but we don't pull any of that into it on that. So it's important that I be on the team. I'm actually the leader of the team, but I don't have to be the leader of the team. But you need to have the scientist able to interact with the artist on a daily basis, mm-hmm. so that when they start going off, wandering off into regions mm-hmm. that they shouldn't go into, you can say, no, you can't do that. We have no justification for doing that kind of thing. And so it's that partnership between the scientists mm-hmm. and the artists that we work through, because, you know, when I do it, I'm a scientist, and I'm gonna do all my visualization things mm-hmm. according to my principles, but I won't do it as well as they do, and vice versa. You know, they're gonna do it really beautiful, but sometimes, you know, one of my artists, he was trained in, if it looks good, it is good.
Right.
And right. I'm slowly breaking him of that, because you know, it has to be scientifically correct. Question.
So, I want to ask. So you're talking about the scientists guiding the artists and the artists, the renderings, like helping scientific intuition. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, what is a little bit more about your thoughts of relationship between art and science? Are there instances where the artists and the artistic renderings help the scientists to make discoveries?
Right. I will say my PhD thesis. I did visualization of it I did some 3D visualization of it, and the main results came out of the intuition I gained from that. On the Eagle Pillars, Anna McLeod, who was the lead author of the paper that we used for our basis, had come up with a toy model of how the pillars are located. And we showed her in 3D why her model was wrong. And we just very gently said, well, I think that this one should actually be tilted more like this because, well, and she was like, oh, you're right. Yeah, so being able to see that, because, you know, most of the toy models that you see in scientific papers are just that. They haven't thought through them extremely carefully.
Sure.
They aren't trained to really see things in 3D. This astronomer is, because, hey, it's my job. So. What I've always enjoyed. Mm. But yes, the play back and forth really does work on things. And there are many other examples from other sequences. I got an email from Lars Hernquist, who I used his galaxy collision in one thing. He was like, wow, I never saw that before. I might actually believe my simulations now. You know, because I showed him something that he was like, oh, that really makes sense. All right. So he actually had more trust in his output, because he's a very skeptical guy on things like that. Question here.
Going back to the fly through, have y'all calculated how fast y'all are flying through some of these?
Every now and then somebody on YouTube asks, oh, how fast are you flying? And I do the calculation. And you know, it's hundreds of thousands to millions of times the speed of light.
Because
I mean, you're covering light years in seconds,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And there's pi times 10 to the 7th seconds in a year, so it's on order 10 to the 7th, right?
Wow.
Yeah, it's back there.
I have a two-part question.
Sure.
Bear with me. I love the aesthetics. I love the color. But one thing that has always stuck with me is when you receive your raw edits, is it just black and white?
Yes.
And then you filter out for the colors. And then my second question is,
almost,
are the colors definite? Is that like the definite color of that gas? Like, how do we know that these are these correct colors that are emitted when we're looking at a photo? Because I see a lot online, and I'm always just curious about that.
Right.
How you
and get there
it, what
are,
it looks like versus what the end result.
There's a lot of crap online, too. Okay. First answer, Hubble and Webb only take black and white images, okay? But they take them in different filters, okay? So I don't know if you know this, but your camera only takes black and white images, but it takes a red black and white image, a green black and white image, and a blue black and white image at the same time, combines them together, and shows you a color image, okay? So it's doing in hardware what we are going, what we do in our post-processing. So we'll get a red, we'll get a green, we'll get a blue, okay? Or we'll get a sulfur, we'll get a hydrogen, we'll get an oxygen, and we will then color each of those images and then combine them using Photoshop or other image editing tools, okay? All right, now, question for you. Can you see in the near infrared? Okay, so this is completely a near infrared image. We have no idea what colors it would actually be because we can't see in infrared. So what we have done is we have translated the near infrared colors to visible light colors, okay? So what we generally do, and this is my hard and fast rule, but it's a generally do, is we take the shortest wavelength that is observed and we put that in the blue channel, the medium wavelength in the green channel, the longest wavelength in the red channel, okay? They did that at Spitzer where they had the MIPS thing, and there was basically, you know, generally 2 micron, 4 micron, and 8 micron, or, you know, sometimes up to 20 micron things in the near in the infrared. And so it's a translation of what we're observing into optical light, okay? Now, there is, of course, some artistic license allowed here, okay? To make sure that, you know, I mean, look at the golden colors here, okay? If you can tweak those things to get that golden color come out, oh, it's beautiful, okay? But everything comes from the data, okay? So this is the image that's observed. Now, the other thing, and how many people do astrophotography here? Okay, transfer functions, right? You've got to stretch your images because, you know, especially with a galaxy, you got that big honking bright bulge here, and then you got all this faint wispy stuff towards the end of the spiral arms. You want to be able to balance that so you can see, you don't oversaturate the bright stuff, but you can still see the faint stuff. And that's called a transfer function, a stretch of various things. We will do those stretches, and we'll even do what we call selective stretches. Especially in galaxies, the bulge is stretched in one, this region around the bulge is stretched using one function, mm-hmm. and the stuff towards the edge is stretched using a different function, okay? This is to bring out the maximum detail so you can see what's going on there. Could any human eye ever see any of this detail? No, the contrast ratio is so incredibly large, okay? We're trying to get, you know, contrast ratios that you just can't see. No camera, no reasonable exposure could get all of this detail, but that's what we're enhancing it for you. But again, it is all the data. Now, the only time that we change the data is to remove artifacts. So the telescopes will have internal reflections, mm-hmm. and sometimes there are these funny figure eight symbols in there. Not real, okay? Artifact due to the telescope. Detector noise. You're observing in space. There are cosmic rays in space. So the detector gets hit all the time, these cosmic rays, and you get these little blips, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, fortunately, if you take two images of the same place, the cosmic rays in each are gonna be different. So if you get these little one pixel hits, and it's not repeatable between images, you can usually filter those out, okay? But you know, sometimes if you filter out a cosmic ray, you're actually erasing a star and all the civilizations that are living around that star. Oh well, we're not much we can do about that in terms of those things. For our visualizations, as I said, we only have so much data, so much knowledge, and we have to fill it in with artistic license. So as I like to say, we use scientific knowledge where we have it. We use scientific intuition, we extrapolate to extend further. And then when we don't have anything, we just, we allow ourselves some artistic license, but scientifically guided artistic license. Okay? Yeah.
As your team grew from probably 4 to 9,
yes.
Did you gain or lose any astrophysicists?
I have been the only astrophysicist the entire time. So I've been the only astronomer in the team. Now, on every project, we employ what we call a subject matter expert. Why? Because NASA deems that we must call them a subject matter expert. So like Anna McLeod was our subject matter expert for the Pillars of Creation, okay? And so upcoming project I'm working with. I'm meeting on Tuesday with Adam, who is going to be our subject matter expert on the next project that we're working on, okay? Mm-hmm. So I have some, I will read lots of papers. I will become a mini expert in any object that I'm visualizing. I always want to have a real expert who I can go to and say, hey, you know, I think this means this. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they come back to me and say, yeah, you're exactly right. Or say, no, that's not really quite what it is. And sometimes they come back to me and say, well, I don't know if you're right, but I can't prove that you're wrong, so you can go ahead and use that, okay? Mm-hmm. And in particular, I remember that happened on Eta Car. We were spinning Eta Car, and we could see two blowouts. And I was like, I want to put a third one back here, because it just will look better on this. And it just, the symmetry to me feels like if you're going to have stuff coming, it's going to come out in, so that there was one going out to the back. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's reasonable. I can't show you you're wrong, so go ahead and use it. So, stuff like that.
So you do have a question online?
I'm sure we do.
Carl, do you want to ask or you want me to read it?
Yeah, you can just read it, Elizabeth.
Great talk. Have you used web data to visualize the early universe?
I have done a bit of that. Whoops, where am I trying to find? I'm trying to that. So I have done visualization of both the Sears Galaxy Catalog and the Jades Galaxy Catalog. Okay, so Sears and Jades are two of the big surveys that look deep into the universe, like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, but done with Webb. Okay, and in particular from Sears and Jades, we've gotten Redshift 12 galaxies, and I believe a Redshift 14, if it hasn't been announced, it'll be announced soon. I think it's been announced. And so we're seeing, while these aren't galaxies, we're seeing proto-galaxies few hundreds of millions of years after the Big Bang. So I flew through the Sears field, you know, all these galaxies floating past you, okay, until we got to the tiny little red dot of Macy's galaxy, okay? We released that relative, I think, and then we did the same thing for Jades, but we had a different feel to it in terms of what we're doing. So yeah, that's one of my bread and butters is being able to fly through galaxy fields. And
thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions online? Okay.
Yes.
So have you worked with other countries' space agencies and collaborated with their specialists in astrophysicists?
Okay. I know a lot of visualizers from around the world. However, I'm paid by indirectly through NASA. I work at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and we are paid. We're subcontractors to NASA, so our job is to work with NASA folks. Okay. I collaborate with folks up at the Center for Astrophysics in Harvard, and at IPAC at Caltech. And such on a regular basis, because they're also paid for by NASA. I have not done any official collaborations with folks from other countries. I've met them at the, say, for example, the International Planetarium Society conferences or at AAAS meetings and other things, no official collaborations. Yes.
I have one question. I think you showed the Hubble optical, basically. You mean visible, right?
Visible light, optical light, yes. Astronomers generally call it optical light, optical telescopes. I remember one day going, oh, yeah, that's a good reason. But anyways, so visible, optical, same thing. Go.
Yes, but the point is, I think you already mentioned that RGB, etc., as you know, record it, we do have this bare array or whatever array you can use. But my question is, in this case, are you really doing multi-wavelength photography, or are you recording, or is it really RGB? Because then what will be the bandwidth of RGB?
Okay, so the rods and cones in your eyes, there are the red, and there are green, and there are blue, and they have different response functions, okay? Astronomers likewise have built a filters set that has a broadband blue, okay? It's mostly at the blue end of the optical spectrum. Then there's a broadband green, or it's usually called the V filter, that's in the center of the optical spectrum. And then there's an R filter that's toward the end. And so our closest we can get to what the human eye would see is if we use broadband R, V, and B. But we can also go into the ultraviolet. We can also go a little bit into the air, the I band, and even the Z band, et cetera, using Hubble. But we also, as I said, we use specific filters, most popular being hydrogen alpha, right? Being able to see the emission from ionized gas. When hydrogen ionizes, you get lots of hydrogen alpha emission, okay? So we have these wide filters that cover hundreds of nanometers, and then we got some medium filters that cover, you know, 50, tens of nanometers, and then we got these narrowband filters which covers like less than 10 nanometers of wavelength all throughout. And we, as the visualizers, don't get to control what those filters are used. The scientists who want to find, understand what's going on, they control what filters are being used, okay? And we just deal with whatever we've got, and then we can build them up. One of the interesting things is like H-alpha is at 656, and then there's a nitrogen line at like 658, okay? And those two can show totally different structures inside the object, but they're both red. Okay, so if you colored them both red, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart.
Right.
So generally, you'd color the hydrogen red because, you know, after David Malan, everybody thinks of hydrogen alpha is red. Mm-hmm. And then the nitrogen, you can give that a different color so that you can tell, you can differentiate what you're seeing in the different filters.
Well, isn't the Hubble palette the whole point that hydrogen is no longer red?
Yes, yeah. That's one of the things that makes it intriguing to the eye.
Yeah.
Yes. Hold on. Let's see. You've had a question recently. Get back
just
to you.
Just out of curiosity. So these nebula, we're not inside a nebula, but without like, if we were in the middle of a nebula, would we be able to tell
the human eye right,
or not?
Probably not. Okay. Right. Can you, as bright as you can see it in the night sky here, is as bright it would appear even if you're in it. Okay. Because there's a really cool thing. Yes, you get really close to it, but it also gets bigger,
right?
Okay, so there's a 1/r² effect of getting closer, and then there's an r squared effect of it getting bigger, and they balance out. So a nebula that's very faint to you, to the human eye from Earth, is still gonna be very faint to you, even if you're inside that nebula. And it's one of those things like, oh yeah, right. So when we fly to the Orion Nebula on the things, it doesn't get any brighter. Per unit area on the sky. Okay? Yeah.
So a question about a bit of follow-up. Has your team, as you worked with ways of presenting your visualizations to people who have sight impairment, from color blindness to limited vision?
We have done an audio description of the last several of our visualizations. This is something I'm not a specialist in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a visualizer, guys. I create visuals for people who see. I do, however, work with people who truly care about that audience,
mm-hmm.
and will try and transform it. Okay, and so we've had after I've done the music and we do the narration and we put it all together. We then go to somebody and say, okay, describe this for people who aren't visually impaired.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they find the spaces in between the narration, and they add in visual description on that. Okay, we've never done a full visual description where there's no narration on that. It still has the normal narration and such. But that's what we can do. There are others who also take the images and print them so that they can be tactile.
And that's all I need for my follow-up.
Okay.
That tactile printout actually has a huge dependency on 3D modeling. Have you actually sent your 3D models to people who want to make tactile printouts?
We find that when they do a tactile model, what they're trying to do is say that this region over here has this characteristic, and this region has this. The correct 3D dimensional structure doesn't really isn't really matter. They're more trying to put the different textures to it and everything. Okay, we do actually have on. My God, NASA took over all our websites. So we used to have on we do have on the Universe of Learning website a 3D printable model of those four pillars. Okay. Wow. So if you want to 3D print the pillars of creation, according to our model, we have a downloadable model that you can print.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a quick question.
Sure.
Have you visualized any images from radio telescopes?
Once. We did the elliptical galaxy that contains Hercules A, and we contrasted the size of the, this is an elliptical galaxy, it's a pretty big elliptical galaxy, but the radio jets go out like here, and I thought that was really cool. And so we took the NRA, the VLA radio observation, put it in 3D along with the optical from Hubble. And that was a lot of fun.
And with those pillars of creation, I wonder how they might look in a radio telescope.
I don't think that they're terribly radio bright, unfortunately. I can check. I don't remember using any radio references when I was doing my research on those.
It's also the resolution too.
Yeah.
Well, so I mean, the thing is, radios has the higher, so much higher resolution than Hubble does. Because you get the VLA in its three different configurations, and bam, you can get micro arc second resolution, not just milli arc second resolution. So, yeah, the highest resolution imagery is out there is the radio, but you need electrons spinning in magnetic fields to really get good radio things. So, like supernova remnants, okay, mm-hmm. That would be something that I think. And unfortunately, NASA doesn't have radio telescopes, so I'm not paid to do radio. There. Okay. Yep. One more.
So, have you done any visualizations on a terrain of any terrestrial bodies?
No. There are a tremendous number of people, especially at Goddard Space Flight Center over here, that they do terrain so much better than I ever would. They use all the geospatial stuff. So I stay in my lane. I stick with the astrophysics stuff. Jeff.
So, something.
By the way, if everybody doesn't know, Jeff Gerber and I went to high school together. Okay? We have known each other. God, I don't know. I don't want to calculate that number.
Exponential notation.
Well, I was also going to ask you afterwards if you've heard anything about whether we're having a reunion coming up this year.
Yeah.
Since it's 45 years. But,
are we 45? Yeah.
So, something Frank did not. Tell us is that back in the 1980s he was a nationally ranked ice dancer there. So Frank, my question then for you
I have so many slides in my slide decks. I have this whole thing on how does an astronomer get to be an astrophysicist. Part of the reason is because this is me 40 something years ago. I was a competitive ice dancer, and I was ranked 10th in the U.S.
That's impressive.
I did not make it to the Olympics, okay? So, yes.
So my question then was, you find that your experience in ice dancing and, I suppose, both the artistic and, I suppose, the... three-dimensional sense that I imagine you would need for that, that has helped you sort of bridging the gap, so to speak, between the scientists and the artists that who you work with.
Absolutely, immensely. This section of my talk is called The Training of an Accidental Astrophysicist. I never imagined there was a career like this. I was never trying for this career. But when I did Cosmic Voyage, I found that I was the one who talked to the artistic people better than any other scientist because I had this dance training. It wasn't just ice dancing. This is me my senior year in high school, okay, doing, I think this is Cinderella. at the Ballet Cinderella. I met my wife at the ballroom dance club at Berkeley. Okay, so I've always had this artistic side to me, and I think, and especially in being a dance choreographer, at which I did at Virginia Tech, it gave me a sense of 3D and motion. When we do those fly-throughs, okay, I'm the one doing the camera choreography, okay? That's one of the hardest things to do in 3D modeling, and it just feels right to me, because I think it's because of my dance training. So I didn't start out trying to do this, but I've ended up in the career I'm in because I have the variety of background experience. Yes.
How do I say this? How much of this stuff gets through to kids in, you know, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, ninth grade? Is there a way mechanically, a process for getting it into schools?
We did have a program that worked, an education program that worked with a lot of schools. I used to do 50, 60 talks in schools a year. We piloted a lot of programs to get things into schools. The Department of Education said NASA should not be doing education. And in 2016, our entire education department was cut.
In 2016? The first Trump?
No, this was before Trump, unfortunately.
Really? What was the rationale for that?
Because the Department of Education said NASA should not be doing education. She should not be working with schools. And so our entire formal education program that we...
Never fought out in court or anywhere?
It came down through the federal government.
Wow.
Very flimsy.
And it's part of, you know, why are we having duplication within the government, okay? The reason we don't have the Hubble site and webtelescope.org and the Hubble Space Telescope YouTube channel is because government says, that duplicates what's on NASA.gov, so get rid of those, and everybody come to NASA.gov.
Do you have contact with anyone who potentially in the future could contravene that?
I wish I did. I know my specialty. My specialty is what you saw here tonight.
This is obviously spectacular stuff. And if we could get, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old kids to see this stuff, a change!
And we have the surveys that show that this does inspire people. A lot of what we do in universal learning is we start to open people's eyes. Okay, we're not a formal education program. We can't be a formal education program, but we can inspire them to want to learn more. And if we can get it out, we have after-school programs. Girls Steam Ahead with NASA. That will try and get this type of material out to people in after-school programs. Not during school, we're not allowed to do that, but after-school programs and stuff like that.
Something wrong here.
There's a lot of informal education programs through NASA. They've been very creative in how they've sort of redone some of their programming.
And what I used to love most, okay, and let me tell you, I would come down to Goddard here, and teachers from Pennsylvania, so the Pennsylvania Math and Science something collective, and they would come down for several weeks of intensive, and basically it built up so that we did an entire week with them, going through all of the various things that we did. As a matter of fact, 2016 was the last year that we did that. And it was just fantastic because I got to teach the teachers and give them all these resources that they could then, multiplier effect, okay? I teach 30 teachers, they teach, 100 students each, boom, you get a lot of people. These are the rules.
Structural problem here.
There is I was not in favor of the change. How about that? Question here.
Easy one for you, but is your most popular work also your favorite to work on, or is there one that was more fun to work on than deserved?
Well, I gotta say, the Pillars of Creation was a blast to work on, and it's one of our most popular. Probably my most popular was the Galaxy Collision one on things. I don't know. I just like working on big projects. Okay, so I don't have a favorite child.
I got a quick question. You've seen the movie Contact.
Yes.
What was your impression of the astronomical visualizations?
Oh, fine for the time. Okay. I mean, the opening sequence was kind of cool, right? Mm-hmm. And they pull
right.
back.
The opening
shot. Pull back, and they pull right. back through the pillars of creation.
Right.
And, you know, when you pull back through that,
mm-hmm.
it goes by so quickly you don't have a chance to study
right.
and see all the flaws.
Sure.
So that's one of the ways, by the way, that you hide flaws, is you back up through something, okay?
Yeah.
If you go forward through it, you watch the whole thing, and it gets bigger and bigger, and you're going, wait a minute, I can scrutinize this. But if you back through it, you can hide a lot of flaws and such. Most science fiction isn't trying to be particularly accurate,
right.
okay? Except I will tell you that Project Hail Mary, I consulted with them for a few hours,
mm-hmm.
and they impressed me that even the director, I said, like, you're probably going to do this because, you know, it's just easier and everything. And it was like, well, they wanted to get that feel of
mm-hmm.
Apollo missions where there's the stark bright and the stark dark right
mm-hmm.
next to each other and stuff. And so I got to actually say, all right, well, in that case, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm told that there's some discussion of, oh, switching over to infrared, which is probably based upon the discussion they had with me. So,
sure.
you know, cool. when you see Project Hail Mary, you'll see there's probably, you know, 10 seconds worth of, oh, hey, Frank probably helped with that. I don't know exactly what part of my you or not, actually that was the thing. You're speaking of favorites.
Yeah.
That is the favorite thing my daughter has ever seen me work on. She was jumping up and down. Consult. She loves that book. She was just
yeah,
jumping up and down and hugging me like, oh my God, you're helping them on this one. It's gonna be so that's like her favorite book of all time and such. All right.
I guess we're wrapped up.
Yep,
thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Okay. So if you want to stop share.
I will stop my share.
All right, we'll see y'all next month.
Yeah.
Is there anyone who wants to see the we're not going to be able to observe because it's cloudy, I think.
Yeah, mostly.
But if anyone who wants to see the telescopes, let me know and I'll take you down to see the telescopes. All right, folks online, I'm going to end the, I'm going to stop.
Only to ask us after recording has stopped. And that is the composer that you.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
All right.
Okay, so the Eric Whitaker Project.